Warning: the first portion of the following podcast contains adult language, sexual imagery, and stuff to make you say, "Man, that's a dirty play." You have been warned. Skip to the
10-minute, 10-second
mark if easily offended. Well met, and welcome to episode 140 of the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for November the 27th, 2016. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings, this is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast we continue our discussion of Timon of Athens with a look at body in the play, as well as a short discussion on the co-authorship question, both in general and within the play itself. Alright, so let's get started with the body, get it out of the way. So if you don't want to hear the dirty, skip to the
10-minute, 10-second
mark in the podcast. Explicit content, adult language, sexual imagery ahead. Skip if easily offended. This is your last warning. Okay, so Eric Partridge, in his study of and dictionary for the body in the Bard, Shakespeare's body, had this to say about our play. Timon of Athens is, in Act 3, Scene 6, through the end, the most misanthropic of Shakespeare's plays, sexually as well as generally, quantitatively comparable with All's Well, Hamlet, and Lear. So let's have a little refresher on how we felt about the body in those plays. First of all, Hamlet. We said that that play sucked the fun out of the body, and not in a good way. All's Well, we made the journey from virginity to prostitution in what Partridge called not a nice play. And Lear, we found misogynistic and largely humorless in its nudge-nudge-wink-wink. So, caution, this is not going to be pretty. When Timon and the Flatterers greet Apamantus, we get an exchange that is barely sexual, but certainly curse-worthy. The painter says, "You're a dog." Apamantus says, "Thy mother's of my generation. What's she if I be a dog?" Timon: "Wilt dine with me, Apamantus?" Apamantus: "No, I eat not lords." Timon: "Thou shouldst anger ladies." Apamantus: "Oh, they eat lords, so they come by great bellies." Timon: "That's a lascivious apprehension." Now, the painter calls the cynic a dog. The cynic responds that the painter's mother is the same species of the cynic, so what does that make her? Double points for being both a yo mama joke and insultingly calling her a bitch. Then we get this statement that women sexually consume or eat men and thus become pregnant. Great bellies. Believe it or not, this is the most fun body passage we're going to discuss today. Sad. When, at the banquet, one of the dancing ladies tells Apamantus to take them at their best, he responds, "Faith, for the worst is filthy, and what's not hold taking, I doubt me." This is the first of many disease references in the play. The ladies are sexually filthy, the cynic claims, so riddled with disease that no man would want to take hold of them. In Act 2, Scene 2, Apamantus and the fool trade barbs with the servants waiting to ask Timon for repayment of loans. The fool mentions Corinth, a city notorious in Shakespeare's day for its brothels. Then we learn that the fool's mistress is a bawd because when men come to borrow, they approach sadly and go away merry, but they enter his mistress's house merrily and go away sadly, satiated but guilt and possibly disease-ridden. Timon, in his first Act 4 misanthropic torrent of a soliloquy, curses the virgins of Athens to become general filths or common whores, then calls for lust and liberty to creep in the minds and marrow of our youth so that they will then be covered with itches and blains, the effects of sexually transmitted diseases. He continues in this vein two scenes later in another soliloquy. His newfound gold makes the whore leprosy adored, that makes the wapened widow wed again, she whom the spital house and ulcerous sores would cast the gorge at, this embalms and spices to the April day again. There's lots of disturbing imagery here. Gold will make the old white-haired, whore, diseased woman adored, and that the word whore, H-O-A-R, is a homonym for whore, W-H-O-R-E, is no coincidence. Gold will also make the worn out, wappened, widow wid again. Now that could mean marry, or it could just mean have sex. This old woman, who would make the sick in a hospital, spital, throw up, would be made young again by this gold. When Alcibiades arrives with his two mistresses, Timon denounces them as being deadly or fell whores, a brace of harlots, and sluts. He tells one of them, Tamanda, be a whore still. They love thee not that use thee. Give them diseases, leaving with thee their lust. Make use of thy salt hours. Season the slaves for tubs and baths. Bring down the rose-cheeked youth to the tub fast and the diet. Here he tells her that since her Johns don't love her, that she should give them diseases, ones that would be treated with tubs and baths, as well as abstinence, the tub fast, and medicinal diets. And it's not just whores he mistrusts, telling the soldier to strike me the counterfeit matron. It is her habit only that is honest, herself's a bawd. Let not the virgin cheeks make soft thy trenchant sword, for those milk paps that through the window bars bore at men's eyes are not within the leaf of pity writ, but set them down horrible traitors. Timon sees all women as false, counterfeit, hiding behind a guise of chastity, honest, all the while a whore, bawd. He says to not have pity on the virgins either, because as they flash their tits, those milk paps, at men, making them teases and traitors. Extra body bonus points here. One of Alcibiades' companions is named Phrynia, which seems to be a reference to the ancient Greek courtesan Phryne, who, while on trial, according to legend, flashed her tits at the jury and got off. Pun totally intended. Anyway, then, as if obsessed, Timon goes back to horrors and disease. Enough to make a whore fair swear her trade, and to make horrors a bawd. Hold up, you sluts, strong shudders into heavenly agues. Be strong in whore, allure the pious man, burn him up, let your close fire predominate his smoke, and be no turncoats. Yet may your pains 6 months be quite contrary, and thatch your poor thin roofs with burdens of the dead. Some that were hanged, no matter, wear them, betray them, whore still. Paint till a horse may mire upon your face, a pox of wrinkles. Consumptions sow in hollow bones of man, strike their sharp sins and mar men's spurring. Whore the flamen, that scolds against the quality of flesh, and not believe himself. Down with the nose, down with it flat, take the bridge quite away of him that, his particular to foresee, smells from the great general wheel. Make curled pate ruffians bald, and let the unscarred braggarts of the war derive some pain from you. Plague all, that your activity may defeat and quell the source of all erection. Wow. He tells them to not stop being whores so that they can bring disease, almost wholly, strong shudders to heavenly agues, even to the pious man, whom shall have his burning desire burned out by their disease. But then he says that within half a year they'll be feeling the pain of the disease themselves, so much so that to disguise their disease they'll have to wear wigs, thatch your poor thin roofs, and cover themselves in so much makeup as might trap a horse. He then turns to how their customers shall feel the disease. Pain in bones, pale with skin diseases, loss of noses and other facial features, loss of hair. This, Timon hopes, will kill off men's lust, the source of all erection. Not fun. Later in the scene, when Apamantus comes to check on Timon, we revisit a piece of body from back in Romeo and Juliet when Apamantus puns on meddlers, those who meddle in other people's business, and meddler apples. Back in our discussion of that early play, I said, then Mercutio pictures Romeo sitting under a medlar tree. Now, the medlar was a type of apple, more on that in just a second, but it was also an Elizabethan slang for the vulva. And what would Romeo do under that tree? Why, wish that Rosaline was a medlar apple. And why do maids laugh when talking about the medlar? Because the medlar had the shape of an open arse, which is both an open ass, but also another name for the medlar apple. So, we've got that working for us. Now, our last bit of body comes after Timon's death, as the final scene is beginning with Alcibiades at the gates of Athens. He talks of the breathless wrong that sit in the throne of Athens, and the insolence that farts breaks his wind. And thus, body and Timon of Athens ends not with a bang, but with a fart. Sorry, T.S. Eliot. No fun, no sex, just disease and horrors, which reminds me more of Troilus and Cressida than the trifecta of Hamlet, All's Well, and Lear, even though Partridge is on the mark by lumping Timon in with those three. I just want to shower. And not because I got sweaty in a good way.
Need some teaching resources? Need to adorn your teaching materials with some Shakespearean goodies? Well, check out the Bill Shakespeare Project page on the teacherspayteachers.com site. We've got materials on Romeo and Juliet, Julius Caesar, King Lear, Othello, Troilus and Cressida, and Titus Andronicus, with more on the way all the time. Plus, you can find the handout version of the periodic table of Shakespeare. Now, some are free, some are for purchase, but all quality items. And for those of you who were asking for bigger poster-sized versions of that periodic table, you can order those from our Redbubble page. Links to both pages can be found in the navigation of this here website.
So last week, the hot Shakespeare news was the announcement by the Oxford University Press that their new Oxford Shakespeare series would include updated authorial credits based on recent scholarship. The news release previewed these updates with an attribution for the three Henry VI plays to Christopher Marlowe, with an accompanying announcement that 17 of the now 40 plays that Oxford feels Shakespeare played a part in composing had other writers involved as well. And I've been asked on a number of occasions in the last couple of weeks what my take on all of this is. And I think it's great. I love the fact that they've used a mixture of scholarly experience and expertise with some big data number crunching. Using what is called a word adjacency network analysis, University of Pennsylvania School of Engineering and Applied Science information scientists found similar linguistic fingerprints between some of Shakespeare's plays and those of other credited writers of the period. But doesn't that dilute Shakespeare, some argue? Well, I guess that depends on how you look at this. If you're invested, intellectually or emotionally, in the Bard of Avon as a person, as a playwright, then yeah, sure, this is a blow, especially if it comes to pass that the sections newly attributed to others are the ones that we appraise as being the higher quality content within the plays in question. However, if you're invested in the plays themselves, I think that this news diminishes their stature not at all. Even the text we see today is Shakespeare is a modification, an editorial creation, so the attribution of a play really doesn't make that much of a difference. At least not to me. And I know that at least some of you love the idea of a collaborator. It just makes him more human. Thanks to Gene Hegland for that. And that concept of collaboration makes me think of some of the major current pop wordsmiths, those working in the hip-hop and rap arenas. So many songs from those genres are collaborations. Just check out the track listing from Jay-Z's The Blueprint 3. So maybe the first part of Henry VI credit should sound more like Henry VI Part 1, with the shanking of Dickie York by Willie Shakes featuring C. Marlowe. Extra bonus points for Willie Shakes in choosing a collaborator with street, i.e. dead, cred. I guess that makes me more of a member of the Shakespeare academic complex than a bardolator, but you probably knew that already. Now, so how does this relate to our play? Well, even before the recent Oxford announcement, critical consensus was that Shakespeare did not act alone in the creation of this play. The idea that it is a collaboration of some sort is nearly 200 years old. While some critics once believed that George Chapman may have been the other author, most now believe that it was Thomas Middleton, a younger contemporary of Shakespeare's who was in his mid-20s around the time this play was supposedly written, mid to late 1600s. The basis of this opinion is both by stylistic comparison as well as metrical inconsistencies. The subject matter and rather harsh tone seem to fit with Middleton's other works, both comedies and tragedies, and some of the diction and punctuation used in the play also seems more Middletonian than Shakespearean. I'm willing to bet that the word adjacency network analysis done for the new Oxford Shakespeare series will bear this out as well. But the question remains. Was Middleton the original author with Shakespeare doing cleanup, or did Shakespeare start the play and Middleton finished it off, or did they collaborate together? It seems that Middleton's fingerprints are found mostly in the second scene, the first feast, as well as the entire third act, where the servants are asking for money from the flatterers, the scene with Alcibiades in the Senate, and that final feast, as well as a section from the fourth act's last scene, that with Timon and Flavius. And if this is the case, I would posit that they either worked side by side, or at least concurrently, or that Shakespeare finished off and supplied the opening for the work by Middleton. I just think that it would be weird to have Shakespeare basically provide a first scene and then much of the build-up, though not including the climax, as well as the final act and a bit of the lead-up to the ending, only to hand that off. But, you know, as I say this, I could see that happening as well. And it actually kind of makes sense, allowing the younger apprentice playwright to handle the climax with Shakespeare overseeing it, the shell of the work overall. But it would also work if Middleton had a full play and Shakespeare just punched up the ending and beginning. And of course, the side-by-side co-authorship is definitely feasible too, with each actor taking on what the other didn't want to do. Now, we'll never know for certain, but it's going to be very interesting as I take my second deeper dive into the text to see if I can tell the difference between what has been considered the division of labor. I know that I did feel that many sections were clunky in their meter and that the fifth act was a mess, so it'll be interesting to bring this knowledge, or at least theory, to that deeper read. Stay tuned. There's more to come. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries since our last regular podcast, you've missed out on subjects including YouTube update, Timon of Athens, Timon of Athens initial thoughts, Timon of Athens a question of genre, thought experiment, form versus meaning, revisiting OSF's Timon, Timon the role, body Timon, misanthropic? How about misogynistic? Revisiting the courtesans? Happy Thanksgiving, Timon's past, and Timon of Athens, the acquisition of money. Now, if you want to follow along with our discussion of the play of the month, or 2 months, or you just want a daily fix, you can check out the Bill Shakespeare Project on our Twitter feed or our Facebook page. But remember that those social media outlets are more for news and notes than the current play under study. Regardless, if you have a question about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for November the 27th, 2016. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. And we shall see thee anon.